Irene Grey, Reel 2. Yes, very interesting, Irene, you know, talking about R.J. Mitchell
yes.
and the Spitfire. Yes, and you were continuing the story of that first flight, I think.
That's right.
You? Yes.
The pilot, his nickname was Mutt, M-U-T-T. He was known all over the firm as Mutt Summers. He came down when he brought her down. I, of course, was not there. This is hearsay. And he went up to RJ and he said, don't alter a blankety-blank thing. She's perfect. From there, of course, production went into full steam. I remained with the firm until my marriage, which was in 1937.
How long did RJ, you know, after that test flight, when you say he was in a wheelchair then, would he still have been involved with the firm and the Spitfire?
He was still in contact with his, Mr. Smith, the chief designer who took his place, more or less in an advisory capacity, obviously. But he had achieved his object. He had produced the most wonderful fighter that did not require any further modification.
When you, you know, sort of going back to the beginning, when you left the seaplanes and the Spitfire production, the design, I suppose, and testing started, did you have any idea then that this was going to be something sort of special?
I think most of us did have a vague, inkling, for the simple reason that we all knew war clouds were gathering. Furthermore, the Spitfire was developed, in a way, from the machine that won the Schneider Trophy, which was also designed by R.J. Mitchell, and which I remember seeing the flyover also over Southampton Water. Anyway, poor R.J. died, did not live to see his triumph, not in the Battle of Britain. But anybody with any sense knew thundering well the Spitfire was built in Southampton, and when we could stand in the early days of the war, I at least, and I know many other people must have done, ex-employees, when we saw the dogfights in the sky with a Spitfire, you breathed a prayer of thankfulness that we had RJ, such a brilliant man. He went over, if I remember rightly, sometime before the final test flight, to an international air conference in Germany at the Messerschmitt factory. I was not his secretary, but I was very friendly with his secretary. And she was very disturbed. She spoke to me once and said RJ had been to the Messerschmitt factory, and he came home very concerned because what he had seen there, the mock-up aircraft, which is more or less a pattern for building, he was convinced that the planes he saw, the mock-ups, with very, very slight modification, would be warplanes. And therefore, he went into the firm. He worked day and night to make sure his machine was ready. And he was justified in his thoughts, obviously.
Were you able to sort of see the Spitfire as it was being designed and built? You know, did you feel involved at all with this?
I did a lot of statistic work on it, really. The machine, of course, didn't fly from Woolston because it was Woolston's on the river. And the Spit, of course, was a land plane. But we had a branch at Eastleigh, which is now Southampton Airport, of course. And in her final stages, she, of course, was done at Eastleigh. So that I didn't really, because I remained at Woolston. But I did lots of statistical work on things with her. I felt quite connected with her. And I say, during the actual war years, when I saw dogfights in the sky with the Spitfires and the German planes, I could always immediately visualise RJ's quiet face. He was a very quiet man, very obviously, very studious. And for a while at Woolston, I worked on the, was known as the embodiment loan section. After a while, my chief said, I want to transfer you onto the central switchboard, which I did. It was a very large telephone switchboard. Involved an awful lot in taking coded messages from various RAF bases and transmitting the same way. And for some reason, he put me there because I was supposed to have a telephone voice.
Yes, I'd go along with that.
But anyway, I was there for some time, I say, until my marriage in 37. But I can hear quite distinctly in my mind now RJ's quiet voice coming from his office over the to the switchboard, so quietly, "Get me my house, please, will you, miss?" So very polite, and he never failed at Christmas time to come and say, "Thank you for all the trouble I've caused you for the year." He was an extremely nice man. I shall remember him with affection always.
It must have been, you know, from what you're saying, with daggers being thrown at the wall next to you, this must have been a very different era of flight. Am I right in
thinking? Oh, yes, in flying boats, totally different.
And even in the, you know, development of the Spitfire, would you think that flying was different then?
Decidedly. Oh, yes, I think it was very, very much decidedly different, a completely different technique. With the Spitfire, of course, we had various ex-RAF pilots join the firm as test pilots. Squadron leader Pickering. Memory gets dim, really, remembering the various names now, but it was a very hectic period leading up to the Spitfire. But I say, unfortunately, in a way, in 1937, I married. And although I was intensely interested and would have loved to have seen the Spitfire through to its final, in those days, married women were not allowed to be employed. Oh, no, this was the ruling. As soon as you married, a woman had to leave her job to make way for a single unemployed woman. But it was, I admit, a great wrench to leave the firm. I was intensely interested in it. But nevertheless, 2 years later, I married a very dear man, which I've had him now for 58 years. But that leads up, of course, to war years.
Yes, before we go into the war years, because this is, you know, really very interesting, these young men, the pilots, you know, one gets this sort of image of the Battle of Britain pilot. Would you say these were the sort of forerunners?
Not quite, because I think they were mainly test pilots. They had to put the machine right through all its paces, and if they considered anything could be modified or improved, of course it was their job, that is what they were taking the machines up for. But I have always thought test pilots are very brave men, especially when they take a machine up for the very first time. You don't quite know how it's going to respond. Oh, it's all very well in theory, but you try and put it into practice. And the Spitfire, being a fighter, had to be capable of manoeuvring and turns at terrific speed. So I think perhaps there were more serious-minded men then. Wonderful flyers, yes. But they were obviously testing a machine to see if they could add anything extra to it or if there was anything quite that ought to be taken out. I think it was a slightly different breed because the majority of them were ex-RAF men. But, of course, they'd been in the RAF in a different era to the wartime pilots. And they were all such young men too, weren't they?
Were there any accidents?
What, with the firm, you mean?
With the Spitfire testing.
No, so, not that I remember. But as I say, I left in 37. And so really, my memories or knowledge of the firm after are a bit hazy, obviously. Only the various contacts I had still had with ex-members of the firm.
And what do you think? What was it about the Spitfire? You know, looking at it and seeing it in the dogfights, which was so wonderful.
She was such a beautiful shape, tiny machine. The pilot could only just get in the cockpit. In fact, I don't think a hefty pilot could have managed it. But she was so manoeuvrable. And she had, to my mind anyway, a very, very graceful shape. She reminded me at times of a dragonfly in flight.
And of course, I suppose we now go on to the war years, where you saw many a Spitfire in the
Yes, we did. I left the firm in 1937.
Yes, you were saying earlier, Irene, you know, talking about RJ, that you knew the war clouds were gathering. Is that right? You know, did you anticipate before war broke out that there would be another war?
Well, listening to radio bulletins and things and various press and knowing what was happening in Germany, I think anybody with common sense could see what was happening, was going to happen. You prayed it wouldn't, but it was a question of having to be prepared. And see, 1938 was the year of the Munich crisis. And I can remember the public reaction. Up to now, Germany, of course, had already started her territorial claims. And in 1938, the Prime Minister, then Neville Chamberlain, I remember seeing the picture of him landing at the airport. He had been over to Germany for conference. And if you remember, he was waving a piece of paper and saying in his mind, he had now got peace in our time. He had got Hitler's signature. I think a lot of people at the time said, quite honestly, silly old man, peace in our time. Because it was obvious the clouds were gathering. But looking back, I sometimes wonder if that man was wrongly maligned. Looking back in retrospect, did he know that we were in no position at the time to defend ourselves? And was he just stalling for time? We had 1 year after that in which to try and improve our defences. And I sometimes think, I say he was a much maligned man. Did he know this? Was he playing for time? I don't want to enter into politics. But obviously, when I look back now at the commencement of the war and the state our country was in, I, as an ordinary housewife, can remember sitting after once bombardment, aerial bombardment had started, sitting feeling as everybody else did, utterly defenceless, because at the time you could hear the German bombers going over and dropping their loads. We had an occasional searchlight would rake the sky, but no anti-aircraft guns. And the feeling was, we're just sitting here taking it all, like sitting ducks. I most sincerely hope that our present government, or any other future government, will never again allow our country's defences and cuts in the armed forces to sink to such a level again that we could not defend ourselves. Because this is what it amounted to for the first year of war. And the first night after sitting down, it says sitting ducks, about a year, not being able to do anything to retaliate, hearing the sound of an ACAT gun, anti-aircraft gun, we couldn't believe it. And you looked out of the window, the blacked out window, searchlights were raking the sky, and ACAT guns went into action, blazing out. I think, I may be wrong on this, but I think the policy was they were holding back until they had got enough anti-aircraft guns to make a really good show of it. But the feeling, the lift to morale, was terrific. You no longer felt you were just sitting down, taking everything, and not being able to do anything about it. And the whole, to my mind, the whole spirit of the people lifted. But I do hope we shall never again sink to such a position, because I still don't trust certain nations.
Yes, now, this reminds me of something you said earlier, you know, talking about the lack of preparedness and how, you know, perhaps Chamberlain has been maligned. You were saying about when you went for the job with Supermarine, the secrecy. Would you say in the years that you were there, the security was good?
Yes, Yes, I think so. I think, really, when the question made confidential, I think, really, it was referring to the various correspondence you would see and the various schedules. I think that. As an instance, at the time, some of the girls didn't understand it. When I was transferred to Worston, it was now quite a big firm. They had rebuilt, you know, added to it. We had lots of female employees in the works as well, in the various rib shops and things like that. When they had to build another ladies' toilet facilities, and it was done in a semi-basement, by now the workforce had increased so much it was necessary. And I shall always remember, there are funny aspects as well as serious. Right down the centre of this enormous washroom, semi-underground, was a double row of wash basins, you know, back to back, this sort of thing. And on the opposite walls, cubicles, of course, toilet cubicles. Now, although there was a slight fence between to segregate the works from the staff, and I expect you can understand the works, those snobby things can't mix with us. It was nothing to do with it. It was so easy to get talking if you had got confidential documents to somehow drop an odd word. You don't know who the other girls were, what contacts they had. So this was the whole reason, but it caused many an uproar and many a laugh, as you can imagine. But I think this was really, when the firm said confidentiality or the employment exchange, I think this is the angle they were getting at, that sort of thing, correspondence, because obviously quite a lot of correspondence went up to the Air Ministry and to the various RAF bases around the firm.
Yes. The other thing, you know, before we leave Supermarine, the engines, these would have been, am I right, Rolls-Royce Merlins?
Rolls-Royce Merlins.
Yes. Where were they? What was the link-up between...
Derby, I think they came from, if I remember rightly. They had an office in Mayfair in London, but their manufacturing factory was Derby. Mr. Lappin of Rolls-Royce.
And was everything smooth between the liaison?
Yes, I think so. I never heard of anything really... slight delays occasionally, now and then, obviously. But no, I never heard really anything difficult.
Right, so now, from 1937, war broke out in 1939.
Yes,
could you describe your sort of situation at the time of war? You have explained that you had your lovely husband.
Yes, he's still there.
Yes, I see him in the garden, actually.
Oh, is he gone in the garden? Bless him. Anyway, 1939, it was obvious everybody was on tenterhooks because we all thought war was looming. But nevertheless, inside, you were praying that it wouldn't come. I remember the morning. Can I go back slightly here? Go back to 1938, may I? At the time, of course, things were looking dodgy. And it is about now that our government introduced air raid precautions, asking volunteers to join. It was known as ARP, asking volunteers to train in various ways in case of war. After Chamberlain arriving back home, I and lots of other people joined the air raid precautions, which meant taking courses in first aid, homework, anything, domestic life, rescue work. Therefore, I had been an ARP member for a year, and I had been working mainly on records and things of the local community and keeping contact of names and addresses of people who came in to volunteer to join ARP as air raid wardens, first aid workers, nurses, rescue party, anything that would be required. On the morning of September, when the announcement was made on the radio, I have to tell you that no such guarantee has been received from Germany. Remember? And therefore, we are at war with Germany. I was home listening to the radio with my husband. It was a Sunday morning. Within 10 minutes, somebody banged on my door. You're wanted at headquarters. I went tearing to the local air raid precautions headquarters to find a bevy of men already filling sandbags and stacking round the place as headquarters. And that started my whole time occupation with air raid precautions. I was on an air known as an air raid warden on headquarters control. And there I stayed until the birth of my son in 1943. Then, of course, I had to give up whole time occupation. My baby at the time was more important. But I remained going backwards and forwards, taking him with me in the pram to do any clerical work during the day that I possibly could to help with. But I still remained a member of air raid precautions, and although it was the war years, of course, were very traumatic, obviously, both for the ordinary housewife, men, the spirit of people was absolutely amazing, really. I remember after Chamberlain had made the announcement that we were at war, so often you heard, well, thank the Lord, we know where we are now. Let's get on with it. Because it had been threatened for so long with Hitler's bawling and shouting. And it was a different spirit. People put their backs into it. And it was right throughout the war years. It was a wonderful spirit of helping neighbours. It doesn't matter what it was. And you look back now, at least I do, and I wonder at the spirit of some of the women. We had in this area, which I sometimes reflect now, I look back on the war years, and I consider Totten, as it was then, known as the largest village in England, separated only from Southampton by the River Test, which was fronted by a large bridge known as the Causeway, and still exists, the remaining bridge that is now, although of course it has been widened considerably since those years. But the close proximity to Southampton docks, just the other side, I look back and I regard Totten must have had divine providence to get away with the comparably small amount of damage it did due to its aerial proximity to Southampton. Agreed, we were fortunate in a way because we had so many green fields then, and a lot of high explosives landed in the fields, of course. And of course, Totten then was not so built up as it is now. It is no longer a village, it is a large town, with unfortunately the disappearance of its green fields under concrete, although we are in the perimeter of the New Forest. But there's nothing New Forest left about Totten now, which I very much deplore. The war years...
Yes, if I could just keep you in this sort of period until the fall of France. Now, what was that called?
Dunkirk evacuation?
Yes, until that period from the outbreak of war until the fall of France. You know, the so-called, is it the Phoney War period?
That's right.
Yes. What you know, you were saying about the men immediately filling up the sandbags.
That's right. In preparation.
So that period, do you think in this area the time was used creatively?
Oh, yes.
Was the preparation?
Oh, yes, most decidedly. I am talking, of course, about my own village, so-called village of Totten, but the same applied in Southampton all over, obviously. From the very word we are now at war, it was all systems go as regards whatever you could in defence. For a long period, I can't remember exactly how long, nothing happened. And this is the era, obviously, we began to be known as the phony war. And people used to sometimes become a little bit careless, you know, thinking, oh, it's all bilge, you know. Blackout had been imposed, of course, but occasionally people got a little bit careless about the blackout and perhaps didn't pull their curtains at night. Then part of the poor patrolling air raid warden's job, because they were on patrol from the minute war was declared, would have to quietly go and knock on the door and say, put that light out, please, or cover your window over, which is quite true. You didn't know if the odd sneak German raider was coming in. This went on for some considerable time, this phony war period, as we call it.
Did you have to tell people?
Oh, yes, because although I was officially on headquarters control at headquarters, especially when the bombing started, I was during the day, I was there all day, from about 8 in the morning till about 8 at night, when one of the men would come in after they'd finished work and relieve me. But it went on right throughout the night, 24 hours. It was manned continuously. And the first intimation we had of any trouble, even though it may not have been official trouble, it might have been just a sneak photographer coming over, who knows? Nevertheless, you would get through the New Forest control at Lyndhurst just a brief message, telephone message, air raid warning red, but you knew what it meant. In this area, we had 10 warden's posts scattered, you know, various, all on the telephone. And immediately then, I had to transmit air raid warning red to all the various posts, put them on their guard, in other words. Sometimes nothing happened. It might have been a sneak raider that came in and didn't penetrate as far as here. But you had to be prepared. But then perhaps the telephone would ring and I would get air raid message white, which meant false alarm, everything as it was. They'd probably pushed off somewhere else. At the end of a raid, when they a real raid, I mean, the raiders had disappeared, you would get air raid message green, which signified raid is gone, all clear, until the next one. And when it did finally start, bombing raids started, sometimes the red alert, as it was known, would go on for 24 hours, the whole time. And people were obviously exhausted, but somehow they managed to get through it. And as soon as the air raid warning went, or once bombing really had started, the pattern was, by now, lots of ordinary little householders had been provided with shelters known as the Anderson shelter, steel construction. This is where houses, where they had a garden big enough to put the little shelters. Some people, of course, in flats didn't have any garden. So throughout the area, large public air raid shelters were built, each bearing a number, sheltered number. And the people who didn't have their own garden shelter were allocated a certain number of shelters to go to when the warning sounded. A vivid memory, we had also air raid shelter wardens, people specifically detailed to guard, stand on guard and keep their eye on the shelters if anything went wrong inside. They were very basic, obviously, consisting of this steel shelter, something like the large Nissen huts now. Each provided with a wooden bench each side and very primitive toilet conditions, obviously, because sometimes, say, the raids went on for 24 hours and longer. And all it consisted of was a curtain at one end and very primitive arrangements behind. There was nothing else that could be done. We had one elderly gentleman known as the clearance air raid shelter warden. And every morning his job was to go right round the public air raid shelters, refill the hurricane lamps with oil, and attend to the toilet conditions ready for the same night. It was a pretty loathsome job, but he did it. The shelters, I said, were numbered. And I have a vivid memory of one particular air raid warden